I didn't realize. He broke off and looked down at her with pity and deep concern. I understood it would be a hard blow, but everything? Is it that bad? Yes, Blaine, she said simply. Everything. Not all at once, of course, but now the whole edifice will start to crumble, and I will struggle to shore it up. I will borrow and beg and plead for time, but the foundation is gone from under me. £1 million, Blaine. It's an enormous sum of money. I will stave off the inevitable for a few months, a year perhaps, but it will go faster and faster like a house of cards, and at the end it will come crashing down around me. Santame, I am not a poor man, he began. I could help you. She reached up and laid her forefinger on his lips. There is one thing I would ask from you, she whispered. Not money, but in the days ahead, I will need some comfort. Not often, just when it gets very bad. I will be there whenever you need me, Santane. I promise you that. You have only to call. Oh, Blaine, she turned to him. If only. Yes, Santane. If only. And he took her in his arms. There was no guilt nor fear. Even the terrible threat of ruin and destitution that hung over her seemed to recede when she was in his arms. I wouldn't even mind being poor again, if only I had you beside me always, she whispered, and he could not reply. In desperation, he bowed his head over her and stopped her lips with his mouth. The Portuguese priest-doctor at Coanga Mission took off Lothar de la Rey's arm 2 inches below the elbow. He operated by the bright, flat, white light of the Petromax lantern, and Santane stood at his side, sweating behind the surgical mask, responding to the doctor's request in French, trying to prevent herself freezing in horror at the rasping of the bone saw and the suffocating stench of chloroform and gangrene that filled the daub and thatch hut that served as an operating theatre. When it was over, she slipped away to the earth-pit lavatory and vomited up her revulsion and pity. Alone in the mission hut that had been allocated to her, under the billowing ghostly mosquito net, she could still taste it in the back of her throat. The gangrene smell seemed to have impregnated her skin and lingered in her hair. She prayed that she might never smell it again, nor ever be forced to live through another hour as harrowing as watching the man she had once loved, shorn of a limb, turned into a cripple before her eyes. The prayer was in vain, for at noon the following day, the priest-doctor murmured regretfully, Désolé, mais je manquais l'infection. Il faut couper encore une fois. I'm sorry, but I have missed the infection. It is necessary to cut again. The second time, because she now knew what to expect, seemed even worse than the first. She had to press her fingernails into the palms of her hands to prevent herself fainting as the priest took up the gleaming silver saw and cut through the exposed bone of Lothar's humerus, only inches below the great joint of the shoulder. For 3 days afterwards, Lothar lay in a pale coma, seeming already to have passed the division between life and death. I cannot say. The priest shrugged away her anxious plea for reassurance. It is up to the good Lord now. Then, on the evening of the third day when she entered his hut, the sapphire yellow eyes swiveled towards her in their deep-coloured sockets, and she saw recognition flare for an instant before Lotha's eyelids dropped down over them. However, it was 2 days more before the priest allowed Blaine Malcomus to enter the hut. Blaine cautioned Lotha and placed him under formal arrest. "My sergeant will have complete charge of you until you are past fit to travel by Father Paulus. At that time, you will be brought by boat downriver to the border post at Runtu under strict guard, and from there by road to Windhoek, where you will stand your trial." Lotha lay against the bolster, pale and skeletal thin, his stump wrapped in a turban of gauze bandage, the end stained yellow with iodine, looked like a penguin's wing. He stared at Blaine expressionlessly. "Now, De La Rey, you don't need me to tell you that you will be a lucky man to escape the gallows. But you will give yourself a fighting chance of leniency if you tell us where you have hidden the diamonds, or what you have done with them." He waited for almost a minute, and it was difficult not to be ruffled by that flat yellow stare with which Lotha regarded him. "Do you understand what I am trying to tell you, De La Rey?" He broke the silence, and Lotha rolled his head away, stared out of the painless window of the hut down towards the river bank. "I think you know that I am administrator of the territory. I have power to review your sentence. My recommendation for clemency would almost certainly be acceded to by the Minister of Justice. Don't be a fool, man. Give up the diamonds. They're no use to you where you are going, and I will guarantee you your life in return." Lotha closed his eyes. "Very well, De La Rey. We understand each other, then. Don't expect any mercy from me." He called Sergeant Hansmeier into the hut. "Sergeant, the prisoner has no privileges, none at all. He will be under guard day and night, 24 hours a day, until you hand him over to the appropriate authority in Windhoek. You will be directly responsible to me. You understand?" "Yes, sir." Hansmeier drew himself to attention. "Look after him, Hansmeier. I want this one. I want him badly." Blaine strode out of the hut, down to where Santayne sat alone under the open-sided thatch setengi on the river bank. He dropped into the camp chair beside hers and lit a cheroot. He inhaled the smoke, held it a moment, and then blew it out, forcefully and angrily. "The man is intransigent," he said. "I offered him my personal guarantee of leniency in exchange for your diamonds. He didn't even deign to reply. I don't have the authority to offer him a free pardon, but believe me, if I did, I wouldn't hesitate. As it is, there is nothing more I can do." He drew on the cheroot again and glared out across the wide green river. "I swear he will pay for what he has done to you. Pay in full measure." "Blaine." She laid her hand lightly on his muscular brown forearm. "Spite is too petty an emotion for a man of your stature." He glanced sideways, and despite his rancor, he smiled. "Don't credit me with too much nobility, madam. I am many things, but not a saint." He looked boyish when he grinned like that, except that his green eyes took on a wicked slant, and his ears stuck out at the most endearing angle. "Oh, la, sir, it might be amusing to test the limits of your nobility and sanctity one day." He chuckled with delight. "What a shameless but interesting proposal." And then he became serious again. "Santayne, you know that I should never have come on this expedition. At this moment, my duties are being sadly neglected, and I will certainly have incurred the justified wrath of my superiors in Pretoria. I must get back to my office just as soon as I can. I have arranged with Father Paulus for canoes and paddlers to take us downriver to the border post at Runtu. I hope we will be able to requisition a police truck from there. Hansmeier and his troopers will stay on to guard De La Rey and bring him in as soon as he is fit enough to travel. Santein nodded. Yes, I also have to get back and start picking up the pieces, papering over the cracks. We can leave first light tomorrow. Blaine, I would like to speak to Lothar, to De La Rey, before we leave. When he hesitated, she went on persuasively. A few minutes alone with him, please, Blaine. It's important to me. Santein paused in the doorway of the hut while her eyes adjusted to the gloom. Lothar was sitting up, bare to the waist, a cheap trade blanket spread over his legs. His body was thin and pale. The infection had burned the flesh off his bones, and his ribs were a gaunt rack. "Sergeant Hansmeier, will you leave us alone for a minute?" Santein asked, and she stood aside. As he passed her, Hansmeier said quietly, "I'll be within call, Mrs. Courtney." In the silence that followed, Santein and Lothar stared at each other, and it was she who gave in and spoke first. "If you set out to ruin me, then you have succeeded," she said. And he wriggled the stub of his missing arm, a gesture which was at once both pathetic and obscene. "Who has ruined whom, Santein?" he asked, and she dropped her eyes. "Won't you give me back at least a part of what you have stolen from me?" she asked. "For the sake of what we shared once, long ago." He did not reply, but instead lifted his hand and touched the ancient puckered scar on his chest. She winced, for it was she who had fired that shot from the Luger pistol at the time of her disillusion and revulsion. "The boy has the diamonds, hasn't he?" she asked. She was about to say, "your bastard," but she changed it. "Your son." Lothar remained silent, and she went on impulsively. "Manfred, our son." "I never thought I'd hear you say that." He could not disguise the pleasure in his tone. "Will you remember he is our son, conceived in love, when you are tempted to destroy him also?" "Why should you think I would do that?" "I know you, Santein," he said. "No," she shook her head vehemently. "You do not know me. If he stands in your way, you will destroy him," he said flatly. "Do you truly believe that?" She stared at him. "Do you really believe that I am so ruthless, so vindictive, that I would take my revenge on my own son?" "You have never acknowledged him as that," said Lothar. "I have now," she said. "You have heard me do it more than once in the last few minutes." "Are you promising me that you will not harm him?" "I do not have to promise you, Lothar de la Rey. I am merely saying it. I will not harm Manfred." "And naturally you expect something from me in return," he demanded, leaning forward. He was breathing with difficulty, sweating with the effort of fighting off his physical weakness. His sweat had a rank and sour smell in the gloomy confines of the hut. "Would you offer me anything in return?" she asked quietly. "No," he said. "Nothing." And he sank back against the bolster, exhausted but defiant. "Now let me hear you withdraw your promise."
"I made no promise," she said quietly. "But I repeat, Manfred, our son, is safe from me. I will never deliberately do anything to harm him. I do not give you the same assurance, however."
She turned and called. "Thank you, Sergeant. We have finished our business."
and she stooped to leave. "Santaine!" he cried weakly, and he wanted to tell her, "Your diamonds are in the cleft on the summit of the hill." But when she turned back, he bit down on the words and said only, "Goodbye, Santaine. It is finished at last." The Okavango is one of Africa's most beautiful rivers. It rises in the highlands of the Angolan Plateau above 4,000 feet and flows south and east, a wide, deep torrent of green water that it seems must reach the ocean, so swift and determined is its flow. However, it is a landlocked river, debouching first into the misnamed Okavango swamps, a vast area of lucid lagoons and papyrus banks, studded with islets on which graceful ivory nut palms and great wild figs stand tall. Beyond that, the river emerges again, but shriveled and weakened as it enters the desolation of the Kalahari Desert, and disappears forever beneath those eternal sands. This section of the river that Santaine and Blaine set out upon was that above the swamps, where the river was at its grandest. Their craft was a native Makuro, a dugout canoe fashioned from a single tree trunk over 20 feet long, rounded but not perfectly straight. "The owl and the pussycat put to sea in a beautiful banana-shaped boat," quoth Blaine. And Santaine laughed a little apprehensively until she saw how masterfully their paddlers handled the misshapen craft. They were two amiable coal-black giants of the river tribe. They had the balance of gymnasts, and their bodies were forged and hardened to Grecian perfection by a lifetime of wielding their paddles and their long punting poles. They stood at the stern and the bows, singing their melodious work chant and trimming their narrow, unstable craft with a relaxed, almost instinctive ease. Amidships, Blaine and Santaine lolled on cushions of rawhide stuffed with the fluffy heads of the papyrus reeds. The narrow beam forced them to sit in tandem, with Blaine in the lead, his Lee Enfield rifle across his lap, ready to discourage the close approach of any of the numerous hippopotamus army which infested the river. "The most dangerous animal in Africa by far," he told Santaine. "What about lions and elephants and poisonous snakes?" she challenged. "The old hippo gets 2 humans for every one killed by all the other species put together." This was Santaine's first venture into these parts. She was a creature of the desert, unacquainted with the river or the swamps, unfamiliar with the boundless life they supported. Blaine, on the other hand, knew the river well. He had first been ordered here when serving with General Smuts's expeditionary force in 1915, and had since returned often to hunt and study the wildlife of the region. He seemed to recognize every animal and bird and plant, and he had 100 stories, both true and apocryphal, with which to amuse her. The mood of the river changed constantly. At places it narrowed and raced through rock-lined gaps, and the long canoe flew like a lance upon it. The paddlers directed it past outcrops of fanged rock, upon which the current humped up and split, and with delicate touches of the paddles took them through the creaming whirlpools beyond and into the next flying stretch, where the surface was moulded like green Venetian glass into standing waves by its own speed and momentum. Santaine whooped breathlessly, half in terror and half in exhilaration, like a child on a roller coaster. Then they emerged onto broad, shallow stretches, the flow broken by islands and sandbanks, and bordered by wide floodplains on which grazed herds of wild buffalo, massive, indolent-seeming beasts, black as hell and crusted with dried mud, great bossed horns drooping mournfully over their trumpet-shaped ears, standing belly-deep in the flood plains, lifting their black, drooling muzzles in comical curiosity to watch them pass. "Oh, Plain, what are those? I've never seen them before," she asked.
"Lechwe. This is as far south as you will find them," he replied.
There were vast herds of these robust water antelope, with coarse, wiry red coats, the rams standing as tall as a man's chest and carrying long, gracefully recurved horns. The hornless ewes were fluffy as children's toys. So dense were the herds that when they fled from the human presence, they churned the water until it sounded like the thunderous passage of a steam locomotive heard at a distance. On nearly every tall tree along the river's banks were posted pairs of fish eagles, their white heads shining in the sunlight. They threw back their heads, belling out their throats to chant their weird yelping call as the Mukuro glided past. On the white sandbanks, the long saurian shapes of the crocodiles were silhouetted, ugly and evil, as they lifted themselves on their stubby deformed legs and waddled swiftly to the water's edge. Then, slipping away below the surface, only the twin knobs of their scaly eyebrows still showing. In the shallows, clusters of smooth, rounded boulders, dark grey edged with baby pink, caught Santaine's attention. But she did not recognize them until Blaine warned. "Watch them!" And the paddlers sheered off as one of the huge boulders moved, raising a head the size of a beer keg, gaping red, the mighty jaws lined with tusks of yellow ivory, and it bellowed at them with the deep sardonical laughter of a demented god. Blaine shifted the rifle slightly. "Don't be taken in by that jovial haw-haw-haw. He isn't really amused," he told Santaine, as he worked the bolt and pushed a cartridge into the breech. As he spoke, the bull hippo charged at them through the shallows, breaking the water into white foam with his elephantine bounds, blaring his hoarse menacing laughter, his jaws gaping, clashing the long curved yellow ivories, whose rager edges could scythe the thick fibrous papyrus stems, or crush in the frail sides of a Mukuro, or cut a swimming man into two pieces, with equal ease. The Mukuro drove forward under the long, powerful thrust of the two oarsmen, but the hippopotamus gained on them rapidly, and Blaine sprang to his feet, balancing in the unstable craft. He lifted the rifle to his shoulder and fired so rapidly that the reports blended together, and Santaine flinched at the whiplash of gunfire over her head and looked back, expecting to see the bullet strike on the great fleshy grey head and blood spurt from between those glassy pink-shot little eyes. But Blaine had aimed inches over the beast's forehead. The bristly ears twitched and fluttered like sunbird's wings to the shock of passing shot, and the bull broke his charge and came up short, just his head showing above the surface, blinking rapidly with comical astonishment. The Mukuro pulled swiftly away, and the bull submerged in a huge swirl of green water, as if to cover his embarrassment at his own ineffectual performance. "Are you all right, Santaine?" And Blaine lowered the rifle. "That was a little frosty." She tried to keep her voice level with only partial success. "Not as bad as it seemed. Sound and fury, not too much of the deadly intent." He smiled at her. "I'm glad you didn't kill him."
"Not much point in turning the old boy into 4 tons of rotting carrion and making 20 widows of his fat wives."
"Is that why he chased us? Protecting his females?" she asked.
"Probably, but you can never tell with wild animals. Perhaps one of his cows is calving, or he has unpleasant memories of human hunters, or perhaps he just felt plain bullshit today."
His coolness in crisis had impressed her almost as much as his humanity in sparing the threatening beast. Only schoolgirls worship their heroes, she reminded herself firmly as the canoe sped onwards, and then found herself studying the breadth of Blaine's shoulders and the way he held his head upon them. His dark hair was cut short down the back of his neck, and his neck was strong but not bold, pleasingly proportioned and smooth. Only his ears were too large, and the tips were pink where the sunlight seemed to shine through them. She felt an almost irresistible urge to lean forward and kiss the soft skin just behind where they jutted out. But she controlled herself with a giggle. He turned and demanded, with a smile, "What's so funny?" A girl always feels weak and giggly after Prince Charming saves her from a fire-breathing dragon. "Mythical creatures, dragons," he said. "Don't scoff," she chided him. "Anything is possible here, even dragons and princes. This is Never Never Land. Santa Claus and the Good Fairy are waiting just around the next bend." "You are just a little bit crazy. Do you know that?" said Blaine. "Yes, I know that," she nodded, "and I think I should warn you. It's both contagious and infectious." "Your warning comes too late," and he shook his head sadly. "I think I've caught it already." "Good," she said, and giving in to her whim, she leaned forward and kissed that soft spot behind his ear. He shivered theatrically. "Now look what you've done." He turned again and showed her the goose flesh standing in little pimples on his forearms. "You must promise never to do that again. It's too dangerous," he said. "Like you, I never make promises." She saw the quick shadow of regret and guilt in his eyes and cursed herself for alluding to his lack of commitment to her, and thereby spoiling the mood. "Oh, Blaine, look at those birds. Surely they aren't real, are they? It proves me right, this Never Never Land." She tried to retrieve the mood. They were drifting past a high, sheer bank of red clay, bright as a blood orange, that was perforated by thousands of perfectly round apertures, and a living, swirling cloud of marvellously coloured birds hung over the bank, darting in and out of the myriad entrances to their nesting burrows. "Carmine bee-eaters," Blaine told her, sharing her wonder at the glory of the flashing darts of flaming pink and turquoise blue, with their long, delicately streaming tail feathers and pointed wingtips, sharp as stilettos. "They are so unearthly. I am beginning to believe you," he said. "Perhaps we have indeed passed through the mirror." They spoke little after that, but somehow their silences seemed to bring them even closer. They only touched once more when Santaine laid her hand, palm open, along the side of his neck, and for a moment he covered her hand with his own, a gentle, fleeting exchange. Then Blaine spoke briefly to the leading oarsman. "What is it, Blaine?" she asked. "I told him to find a good place to camp for the night." "Isn't it still very early?" She glanced at the sun. "Yes." He turned and smiled at her almost sheepishly. "But then I am trying for the record trip between Kuanga and Runtu."
"The record?"
"Slowest journey ever," he said. Blaine chose one of the large islands. The white sandbar folded upon itself to form a secret lagoon, clear and green and screened by tall waving papyrus. While the two paddlers piled driftwood for the fire and cut papyrus fronds to thatch night shelters for them, Blaine picked up his rifle. "Where are you going?" Santayne asked.
See if I can get a buck for dinner.
Oh, Blaine, please don't kill anything. Not today, not this special day.
Aren't you tired of bully beef?